KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates. Held as a meeting during the pandemic, Jefferson County Public Health Officer Allison Berry and Department Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz. Now, our brief commissioner and Willie Bentz, they will brief our commissioners and you, our KPTC listeners.
In our region towards the end of this month, which means unfortunately the news I bring for the next couple of weeks is likely to report that the cases are getting worse. Nationwide, we are still seeing incredibly high rates of transmission, approximately 800,000 cases diagnosed every day in the United States. Hospitalizations are still rising nationwide, and unfortunately deaths are as well. Currently, we have about 150,000 people hospitalized for COVID in the United States. That is one of the highest rates that we have ever had. In Washington, we are not at our peak yet at this point. You might hear when you're following national news, there are a couple states that look like they may have peaked when it comes to Omicron, but Washington is not one of them. Currently, we are still seeing our cases just skyrocketing upward. We're seeing about 2,000 cases diagnosed every day in Washington state, and unfortunately, our hospitalizations are also continuing to rise. We are seeing an incredible strain on our hospital capacity statewide, and also on our ability for EMS to transport statewide. So one of the things that happens when a neighboring hospital system is overwhelmed is, say you bring a patient who's critically ill into a Kitsap hospital and they don't have any room in their ER, that paramedic has to wait with them. And that means that they can't come back and take care of us out here. So we ran into a critical shortage of that over the weekend. We basically didn't have the ability to transfer folks out of this region, no matter how sick they were, because too many EMS companies were either busy transporting other people with COVID or other critical illnesses, or they were sick themselves or off the job for a variety of reasons. So the healthcare system is really, really struggling right now. As far as the numbers in Jefferson County, our current case count, we are up to 2,123. That brings us to a case rate of 1,460 per 100,000. That is the highest we have ever seen in our region, with a 22% positivity. The little bit of good news we have in Jefferson, though, is we have only three people who are hospitalized for COVID right now, for a total of 92 hospitalizations and 22 deaths in this response. Compared to neighboring Clallam County, we have a total number in Clallam of 7,890 and a case rate of 2,034 per 100,000. What we're really seeing that's different between the two counties is in Clallam County, the sheer number of people with COVID who are needing to be seen in the ER or in the hospital is really beyond straining that healthcare system. It's nearly buckling under the pressure of all of those patients who need medical care, particularly emergency department medical care. We are actually not seeing that in Jefferson. And that is really thanks to the sheer number of folks in our community who are vaccinated. The vaccines continue to be incredibly effective at preventing hospitalization and death, preventing that need for that hospital level care, which is really good. So we aren't in Jefferson straining our own healthcare system, but the challenge is when all of our neighboring healthcare systems are buckling under the pressure of COVID, that has a ripple effect onto us because we can't get our very sick out. And we do have people who are very sick. We have small healthcare systems that don't normally take care of critically ill people. We don't normally take care of children here, both of which have had to happen recently because we just couldn't get folks transferred to other levels of care. So that's where you'll start to see the challenge of the healthcare system here. We have so far not seen a significant surge of people needing hospital level care in Jefferson in particular, so that's hopeful. But that we still see the challenge of that backlog of either not being able to discharge folks or not being able to get our most critically ill out of Jefferson. But I am very hopeful to see that we aren't seeing the level of hospitalization spike that we've seen in neighboring counties. We certainly have seen a very significant rise in cases, but because so many of those are breakthrough infections of folks who are fully vaccinated, they don't go on then to need hospital level care in the vast majority of cases, and that is hopeful. One common question I hear, or I'm starting to hear a little bit more of lately, is that, you know, when things look this bad, there is a tendency to kind of lose hope or feel like all the work that we have done is for nothing. I've certainly heard that among some folks who've worked really hard to follow all the guidelines. And I think the key thing to see there is that we are in a different position in Jefferson compared to other places because of the work that we've done. We aren't seeing a flooding of our ER. We aren't seeing our own little hospital overwhelmed because of all this work we've done. And it's hard because we can't control what happens around us, but we certainly can keep things like healthcare, things like our schools, critical things that we need more available locally because of all of that good work. We are going to continue to see more cases in the coming weeks because we have not peaked yet. And so we are likely to see some difficulty accessing certain services just due to outbreaks in those spaces. We certainly are working as hard as we can at public health to assist those spaces that are having outbreaks to keep critical infrastructure functioning, but you may experience some delays in accessing certain services due to outbreaks in those spaces. Another common question I get is, why do we keep following all these numbers? Isn't COVID just the flu? It's basically the flu now. I hear Omicron is super mild. And that's not true. Omicron is slightly more mild than the Delta variant if you are unvaccinated, which is still more severe than the original COVID virus that, if we remember back, shut down all of New York City. So this is still a very severe virus. The reason why we report the numbers is actually to help everyone on this call make decisions about how they manage their life based on those numbers. When our numbers are really low, there are a lot of things you can do much more safely. You can gather in large groups, you can go to an indoor wedding, you can do all kinds of things when those numbers are low. But when our numbers are this high, your probability of being exposed in any indoor space, if you've got 10 or 20 people there, especially if they've got masks off, is high. So we give you all of this data so that you can make informed decisions about how you navigate the world and do so safely. These numbers will not always continue to rise. They'll likely rise for the next couple of weeks, and then they'll drop. And then when they drop again, more things become safe. So that's part of why we continue to follow these numbers. We know they are incomplete, partly because so many folks use home tests and not all of those get reported back to us. We know that our percent positivity is over 20%, which means there are a bunch of people who aren't even testing positive that we don't know about. So there are people out there who don't know they're positive. The key there is, if you're sick, gotta stay home. Try to get tested if you can, as soon as you can. You can still get drive-through testing at Jefferson Healthcare. We do still have tests at the health department for as long as they last that we will get to folks who are symptomatic or exposed. And then isolate and tell your friends if you're positive. That's really how we break those chains of transmission. But if you can't get a test, if for whatever reason you're not able to access one, if you're sick, you gotta stay home to reduce that risk of spreading the infection at work. The only other big point I wanted to touch on before we move on to questions is, I do hear from some folks who are young and healthy, who are even vaccinated, who say, hey, you know, I'm not going to die of COVID, so I'm just going to live my life. And that's true. You're not. The probability of getting hospitalized or dying from COVID if you've been vaccinated is low. But the big thing that we worry about is the risk that you could bring COVID to someone else. The biggest reason why people who are young and healthy should be thoughtful about transmitting COVID is because we don't want you to give it to someone else who could then get sick and die. So it's not enough to just measure your own personal risk. You want to measure the risk of everyone around you, in your family, in your community, who could get sick because of you. And that's why we all have to make good, safe decisions to reduce our risk of contracting COVID so we don't pass it on to someone else. So the first thing to do there is to get vaccinated. That's the number one thing you can do to reduce your risk of contracting and spreading COVID and your risk of needing hospitalization. The next big thing you can do is wear a mask when you're in indoor settings around anyone who outside of basically your household at this point, is to wear those masks, wear a good quality mask, and to wear it all the time. And then to limit those social interactions, especially when we're in a peak like this, when there's so much COVID in the community, really limit those out those gatherings, limit the socialization you do outside of your house, bring back that pod for probably the next 3 weeks or so. And then we should be in a much better place by early February. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions. Yes, Greg.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Barry. Grim news indeed, but I'm glad at least our local healthcare system is not over capacity. My question, I just wonder if you could give us a little update how the schools are doing and what you see in the near-term future for schools.
Sure. So our schools are still doing relatively well. We are not seeing widespread transmission in the school setting. So we're not seeing transmission in the classroom, even with this sheer number of cases, which really speaks to the power of the mitigation practices that we have in schools. The challenges that we are seeing for the schools include, one, we are seeing transmission in sports. And so I think part of making decisions as a family means that you need to know what is a high-risk activity and what isn't. And indoor sports right now is a high-risk activity. There's just so much COVID, and that's one of the few places left where we don't wear masks. So when you're competing in a basketball tournament, and often against folks from other counties, we've seen transmission in those kind of settings, even with everything the schools are doing. And they are trying really hard. They're doing a ton of testing, there's masking, but there's just no way to make an indoor basketball game safe right now, just with this amount of COVID. Now, many families will still choose to finish up the season. I know we're nearly through the end of the season for many folks, but it is important to know, especially if you have a high risk child. Now, the number one risk that puts you at risk of getting severely ill if you're a kid is being unvaccinated. So the best thing you can do to protect your kid right now is to get vaccinated. The other key risks for severe disease are having an underlying respiratory issue. So if you have asthma, for example, that can put you at severe risk of COVID, or obesity actually is a pretty significant risk factor. And of course, all the other severe diseases that are less common in children but can happen, things like immunosuppression, cancer, and the like. But most of our severe cases right now with kids are kids who are obese or kids who have asthma. And so if you have a child in that group, I would think about how to make sure we're doing everything we can to keep them safe. And the biggest one there, of course, is to get them vaccinated. Outside of the sports-related outbreaks, the biggest challenges that the schools are facing right now are just the sheer number of cases in the community. So they're not getting it at school, but kids are turning positive right and left, primarily due to household contacts. So they're picking up COVID at home, or they're picking it up by socializing outside of school. And the schools are doing everything they can to keep that out of the classroom, but that means a ton of tracing and a ton of testing. And they've been affected by the testing shortage as well. So unfortunately, two of our districts in Jefferson County ended up with a critical shortage last week where they just didn't have enough tests to go around. The schools did a good job of sharing, put out a call to their neighboring superintendents to find some tests so that we could keep the schools open. But some districts had to stop sports for a little while until we could get the tests to make sports a little bit safer. There was a lot of work through the weekend to move tests to them, including a lot of people driving down to the Olympia area to pick up tests and bring them back to the schools. And so we should be in a better spot this week, but it's been a challenge for them to keep things operational.
Thank you for that. One follow-up just on tests. I'm wondering if you could, I guess, predict, I'm wondering if airline travel and everything, we're going to go to antigen tests, which seem like a more appropriate pre-flight test to me, with what I know, to show if you're actually shedding. And also, can you speak a little bit about the national effort to get, four tests in every household's
Sure. Tests? So yes, the federal government has promised that we can all have up to 4 antigen tests per household that we can order starting on Wednesday. They did set up a website for it where you can go and order your tests. I will be interested to see how that rollout goes. That's a technological challenge to have a website that won't crash when all of the United States tries to log in at once. But I hope it goes well. I would say if you are a Jefferson County resident who's signing up to get your tests, I'd say A, do it, get the free tests. It would be good to get more tests into our region. But B, if you log on and it crashes, try coming back in a half hour or an hour, give it some time. I anticipate that there will be technological challenges. That just is a big lift for any website, no matter how well designed it is. And then know that those tests come in about 1 to 2 weeks based on what the federal government is saying. So they're not something to have right now. If you're sick right now, you have to use one of the tests that we have around. So if you're sick, if you're symptomatic, you can go through the Jefferson drive-thru, or you can, if you are exposed, you can come to Jefferson County Public Health. If you're in South County, you can pick up one of our test kits from Jefferson County Public Health as well, whether you're symptomatic or exposed, because we know it's hard to, we don't want folks to have to drive all the way to Port Townsend to get tested. And there's also testing in South County at some of our fire departments as well. Definitely call ahead. We don't want people with COVID walking into the fire department and getting folks sick, but call ahead and we're happy to help with that. As far as travel testing, I don't know. That's one thing that is outside of my realm of ability to manage, but I certainly think antigen testing would be reasonable for before you get on a plane, figure out whether or not you're contagious going onto that plane. I also think, as far as talking about how we could do travel better, is that we should have a vaccine requirement to fly. Even within this country, the fact that we only have that to fly to other countries is more of a matter of politics than a matter of epidemiology.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, a couple quick questions. If you could maybe just
reiterate. This is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, Washington, and we're listening to the Jefferson County Public Health update.
Isolating and contacting folks, but just want to reiterate the importance of calling the public health department, correct?
Yes, fair. So if you test positive at home, there's a couple key things you can do. The first thing is to stay home. For most folks, the best time to isolate is 10 days. I know there's been a lot of confusion with the CDC guidance. There is a tiny subset of folks, people who are asymptomatic at day 5, who could potentially leave isolation, but the safest thing to do is to stay home for the full 10 days if you test positive, which is 10 days from when your symptoms start or 10 days from when you test if you were asymptomatic when you tested positive. Then the next big thing to do is we do recommend you give us a call at Jefferson County Public Health, and we will give you guidance to the extent that we can. We did have 107 positive tests as of this morning that we were tracking. So you may find, even when you call public health, that it might take a while for us to get back to you and give you some guidance. So we do have some good guidance online for what to do if you test positive. And the next big thing there is if you test positive is to tell the people that you've been around since you were infectious. And you begin being infectious 2 days before your symptoms start and then 10 days after. So anyone you've been around in that time, it's really important to give them a call, let them know that they've been exposed, and you can send them to our website for more guidance about what to do based on that exposure.
Thank you. And I'm curious, are we still expecting, and I know we're seeing less of this locally, but throughout the state, that that hospitalizations are lagging high case counts? So do we anticipate hospitalization and then ultimately deaths to continue to rise even after we peak on the case count?
Yes. So hospitalizations tend to lag by about 2 days. 2 weeks. And so say we hit our peak in cases end of January, our peak hospitalizations will be end of February. So right now we're doing better than all of our neighbors on hospitalizations, but that doesn't mean that things can't get worse as far as hospitalizations go. And certainly this is the highest case count we've ever had. So 2 weeks from now, we certainly could see a larger strain on our healthcare system than we have right now.
And I see we had as many as, was it 5 or 6 patients in our local hospital at some point last week?
Yes, that was our highest so far. We were up to 5 at Jefferson Healthcare. Right now we're down to 2. So it can vary over time. And we are, of course, continuing to work really closely with Jefferson Healthcare. And while I wanna make sure people notice that we have done better in many ways, I don't want folks to get cavalier. Our healthcare system is a critical resource, and they have been strained for 2 years. And so they don't have a lot of extra, they don't have a lot of extra anything. They don't have a lot of extra people, beds, tests. It's going to be really hard if they get a massive strain on them. And so it is still really important that all of us limit our risk of getting infected and limit our risk of needing healthcare in the next couple of weeks. And I think that actually just comes to one other point around folks who say, you know, oh, there's so much COVID or that we're all going to get Omicron, so we might as well just get it. And doing risky things right now to get Omicron because we're going to get it eventually anyway is not a good idea. We're expecting peak strain on our healthcare system early February, 2 weeks from now, which is exactly when you would need it if you contracted COVID right now. I want to encourage everyone to be really cautious, even right now. It is not guaranteed that you are going to get Omicron. Remember, many of us managed to not get COVID back before there were any vaccines, right? There are ways that we can reduce our risk of getting COVID, even when there's a ton around. And now we have a lot more tools to do so. So getting vaccinated and limiting those social interactions is actually really critical right now, because 2 weeks from now, our healthcare system is likely to be in a very different place. And that's right when you would need it if you got infected right now.
So I have one question. My preamble to my question is a comment that, many people I know are going back to their pods and they're only gathering outdoors, which is what we're doing in our household, except for with my mom, for example. But God forbid I brought COVID to my mom. That would be, you know, so, but a question I've gotten a few times. So when I get a question a few times, I think it's worthy of asking.
Sure.
So is the target for lifting the mandate on restaurants still 175 cases to 100,000? Was that what it was originally?
It was 75. Originally. Okay. I think, with Omicron there, and certainly a lot has changed as far as the variant circulating since that was written. I think it's possible that we could consider a higher number actually for lifting that. I don't think that number is 1400 though. So I don't think now is that time, okay. But I do think with Omicron and the way the numbers are likely to shake out, that a higher number, maybe something closer to 200 would be reasonable when we get there.
And that was the crux of the question, is does Omicron change our considerations relative to that?
And I think it has, because of breakthrough infections, because it's to some extent a different type of virus than we saw before. And of course, how infectious it is. I do think that could change that number. It just won't change it to where we are right now.
Right. Mark, you have any questions for Dr. Berry?
None at all.
Okay. So on to the list of KPTZ questions and all our listeners who are out there today.
And we have a slightly shorter list than before, so I think we are going to be able to get through it. One person asked about our thoughts on swabbing kind of the throat and tonsillar area and then swabbing their nose. That's a kind of something that's been circulating online. There is some early indication that a throat swab may actually increase the sensitivity of a nasal swab. I don't recommend folks do that on an at-home swab though. It's very, very hard to swab your own throat. And the nasal swabs are still really good. We're still waiting on more clear data on exactly the best way to swab. And if we see that throat swabs are significantly more sensitive than a good nasal swab, then we'll change our practice. But we don't have that level of data yet. They're all very small, small numbers research papers at this point, which is not enough to change the practice of the entire United States. What is important is to get a good nasal swab. And so that means you go up into your nair, which is just to the top of the soft part. You swab around for a full 10 seconds on both sides, and then you read your antigen test and you wait 15 minutes to read it. Those are the two most common ways you get a false negative: not a good enough swab, so swabbing just one nose, or not swabbing long enough, or reading it too early. We've seen people trying to read them after 3 minutes, and I understand you really want that answer, but we really have to wait for the full 15, because those very faint lines of a low viral load tend to show up at the end. So if you don't wait 15 minutes, you're going to get a false negative. So wait that 15, any line at all, even a little line, even a very faint line is positive, and treat it as such. False positives are incredibly unlikely right now, given the sheer number of cases we have in our community. So any positive is a positive. Other questions. As someone who got COVID over the holidays, I am reading that I should go easy on returning to my former level of exercise. Do you have guidelines about this? And I would say when it comes to COVID, everybody responds differently. Some people have incredibly severe disease. Some people have very mild disease. The key when you're returning to activity is to listen to your body. And don't go too fast too soon, but it's okay to go back to activity. But you might find, many people do, that even after a relatively mild case of COVID, that you have more shortness of breath and less activity tolerance. So just listen to your body. If you need to take it slow for a little while, that's okay. Keep getting out there. Actually, getting regular aerobic exercise is important for your full recovery from COVID. But just start slow, listen to your body, and scale up as you feel able. I think that's the other key thing that we don't talk enough about with COVID is we focus so much on hospitalization because it's so critical. But we do see a lot of folks with prolonged symptoms after COVID, what's called long COVID, of varying degrees of severity. Some is persistent exercise intolerance, some is things like prolonged brain fog, and then some folks are very, very ill. We've seen some triggering of basically an autoimmune disease phenomenon where people have prolonged significant symptoms long after they have COVID. And so that's another reason, even if you're young and healthy, to try to avoid getting COVID. There are potentially significant downstream effects from getting COVID at all. And that do what you can. We know that many people are going to get breakthroughs right now. That doesn't mean you did anything wrong. If you got COVID in spite of your best efforts, please know that that is not a personal failing. That's just a really infectious disease. But if you get COVID in spite of your best efforts and you don't get hospitalized and die, then all of those efforts really did work. I know I spoke just on Friday with a gentleman who was his elderly, has significant chronic conditions, got boosted and got a breakthrough, but he felt fine. He had a cold. And that gentleman very well likely would have died if he'd gotten COVID without all of those interventions, which still matters. I had another person who asked, please help me with a COVID risk evaluation for two situations. One, a 90-minute dental procedure. Two, staying in a hotel, masking in all common areas, and only eating takeout food. So starting with number two, that's actually pretty low risk. So hotels, the risk of hotels is other people. It's not the space. And so if you mask as you go in and you avoid the other exposures that you would get there, like restaurants or whatever other gathering you might be going to that space for, it's actually pretty low risk. So if you sleep in a hotel and then go out and be in the world, be outside, don't go to a large family reunion, pretty low risk. 90-minute dental procedure depends a lot on how your dentist is running their office. Dental procedures are aerosolizing procedures. And so in order to do so safely, there have to be a lot of safeguards within that dentist's office to reduce the risk of spreading those particles to the neighboring chair. And so I would encourage you to talk to your dentist. I don't want folks to not take care of their teeth. Many of our dental offices have been very, very cautious about COVID precautions and have interacted with our office to plan for how to do it, but definitely check in. A dental procedure is a relatively high risk one because you're unmasked for a prolonged period of time and other people are getting aerosolized particles around you. So you wanna make sure that they have a plan for how to manage that. There are ways to do that safely. You just wanna make sure that your office is one that's doing that. This one's, I think, a good one. I know many local families that have had one COVID breakthrough, but the rest of the family remain negative with testing, even though they live in the same home. These are all vaccinated families. So the person wanted to know, is that something that we've seen generally, or is that the work of the vaccine? And it's the work of the vaccine. So we actually have studied this in multiple spaces in our country and in other countries, that being vaccinated reduces what's called the household attack rate, which is the probability that someone in your house gets COVID. And it reduces it if the original person who got COVID was vaccinated, and it reduces even more if everyone else in the household is vaccinated. That doesn't mean it never happens. You can still bring COVID home as a vaccinated person and share it with your family, unfortunately. But the risk of that actually is much, much lower if you're vaccinated. If you have an unvaccinated family, it just runs through. If you have a fully unvaccinated family, nearly 100% of people will get COVID in that space if you're living in the same house. But if you have a fully vaccinated family, we're seeing lots of cases where someone comes home positive, doesn't give it to anyone else, or may give it to one other person. And that really is the power of the vaccine acting there. I may have the opportunity to take some time off and isolate myself alone in my home until medicines like the antivirals and home tests become more widely available. Would such a strategy reduce the risk of my contracting long COVID or other COVID-caused health problems? Yes. So any extent that you can isolate at home right now and reduce your exposures to others, to the extent that that is possible and manageable for you, I recommend that you do. Now is really the time. If you're going to be reducing your exposures to others, this is a good time to do it. I do tend to phrase it less as isolating at home and more as reducing your exposures. Part of what makes it possible for us to do this long term is that we find a way to make it livable. And so for me, that means that I'm vaccinated and boosted, the people in my family who are eligible are vaccinated and boosted, and I have a small pod of people who I continue to see. Because that's what makes this manageable for 2 years. And I encourage all of us to find a way to make it manageable. If it is painful to do it, you're going to stop doing it. And that is actually more dangerous. But if you have the ability, especially if you're very high risk, to really limit those social interactions, to move them outside, I think that is a good idea to do that right now, because numbers are high, hospitals are strained, it's going to get worse for the next couple of weeks, and we don't have that many treatments available because there's just such a shortage right now. That will get better, and then you can start increasing those social interactions again. Just a couple more. This one said, after I got my vaccinations, I was signed up for an automated system where I could report my symptoms, and that didn't happen after my booster shot. Why is that? I think this person is probably talking about something called V-Safe, which is made by the CDC. It's an app on your phone where you can track symptoms and report them directly to the CDC. I don't know why it didn't get signed up after your booster, but it still exists. And if you have it downloaded on your phone from your first vaccinations, you can actually go in and log your booster and then log any symptoms beyond that. Or if it's not currently on your phone, you can actually go back to VSafe, download it again, and use it the same way. It's a tracker used by the CDC to look for risks of side effects related to your vaccine. So you can still use it after your booster. And I did get one other question that came in a little bit late, but I think is probably worth taking some time to answer since we have a couple more minutes. And this person asked basically, why aren't we in lockdown right now? And I think it's a really valid question. When we see this many cases, this much of a strain on the hospital system, this person brought up the very valid confusion about, you know, if it was okay to lock down before, why aren't we doing it right now when things are this bad? I think there's a couple reasons. One is that compared to the beginning of the pandemic, we know a lot more about how this virus spreads. And so some of the things that we stopped doing back in March of 2020, we now know how the virus transmits, and we wouldn't stop doing them this time if we did have a lockdown. You know, anything outdoors, for example, we know is fine. Many interactions where people can stay well masked and spaced out from each other can also be done really safely. So that I think is the biggest thing why, if we did have any major interventions like that, they would be much more focused and targeted than they were before, because now we really know how to stop the virus while keeping things going. But I do think now is the time where it would make sense, in truth, to have more significant limitations on our indoor gatherings and have those kind of things happen on a statewide level. But that really is something that, at least at this point, I think has to happen at least the statewide level. It's not very possible to do that just here in this county. We really need statewide leadership to make that happen. And I do think it would be reasonable for the next 2 weeks or so to close some high-risk venues at a statewide level. I don't think that's going to happen, though. I think one of the biggest reasons likely for that, of why the state hasn't moved forward with that, is we rely to a great extent on voluntary compliance. You know, we don't have a police state. We don't go shut everybody down when this kind of thing happens. And I think the read the state has is that that many people wouldn't comply with an order, which would reduce its efficacy. That's my guess as to why they haven't done it. But it is challenging to watch healthcare systems around our state start to fail, and while everything else is wide open, when we know what works. We are not seeing healthcare system failure here, at least at this point. But I do think statewide, it would make a lot of sense to close some high risk venues for a few weeks while things calm down. The only other thing this person brought up was kind of concerns about going to work. And I think that's also very valid. There are some workplaces that are much higher risk than others. The most important thing you can do to reduce your risk at work is to get vaccinated and to wear a high quality mask at work. But I do want to really encourage all of our employers who are still open to make their workplaces as safe as possible for their employees. And that means enforcing masking, enforcing keeping people home when they're sick, not encouraging folks to come to work sick, and enforcing that if someone's sick, they should get tested, or they should stay out for at the very least 5 days before they come back. It's really when we don't have the state stepping up to close things down, and when we don't have the enforcement capacity to enforce some of these things, it's really up to individual employers to make their workplace as safe as possible. And with that, I'll pass to Willie.
Thank you. So just a quick update on our vaccine operations. We were in Quilcene this past weekend, 62 kids in the morning, followed by 74 adults in the afternoon. So a successful event there. We really appreciate South County's support as always. After the clinic, we did do 9 home visits. So we went to the homes of homebound individuals, folks who couldn't travel for whatever reason out of their home, and were able to get them boosted or vaccinated at their homes. So I do want to put out the call yet again. Please do call us here at DEM. If you are homebound and you are looking to get vaccinated or looking to get your booster, we wait until we have a cluster of folks in relative proximity to one another, usually 5 to 10, before we go out and do a round of home visits. So it's not an immediate appointment. But do please call. We'll put you on a list. And once we do have an appropriate cluster, we'll call you to schedule that appointment and come visit you in the home. So I'm happy to get those 9 homebound individuals finally boosted or vaccinated. So please do call and get on that list. The sooner the better. We've had a couple of folks who've had to wait, a couple of weeks before we got that cluster. To be able to go out and use a whole vial and vaccinate a group. So the sooner you get on that list, the better for us and the better for you. We'll be able to get to you and some others, hopefully a little bit sooner. Other than that, coming up, we're really grateful that the DOH, they call it the CARE van, is coming to visit our community this Saturday. They'll be at Blue Heron from 9 to 11 in the morning on Saturday the 22nd. They'll be offering Pfizer for the under 18 crowd, as well as Moderna, first, second, and booster doses for the rest of us. After they're done in Port Townsend in the morning, they'll be traveling to South County, this time in Brennan, at the Brennan Community Center, where they'll be offering the same, whether it's Pfizer for our youth, Moderna for the adults, and they will have J&J as well. So if you're one of those folks who wants a second dose of J&J, as opposed to one of the mRNA vaccines, that'll be an option for you as well. They'll have all three flavors, so to speak. They'll be at the Brennan Community Center from 1:30 to 3:30. So if you're in South County and you missed out on the Quilcene Clinic, the caravan will be in your neck of the woods come this Saturday. So do sign up there. Finally, last but not least, we are announcing we'll be back at Blue Heron Saturday the 29th. And it's been going to be the same routine as it's been for a couple of weeks now. Pfizer for the kids in the morning, followed by Moderna for adults in the afternoon. As with everything else, go to the public health website, sign up for the clinics, or call us at 344-9791 here at the EOC. Our call center is not staffed right now, but do please leave us a voicemail and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. We can also assist with testing and other questions. But we've had a lot of folks who've been calling and they never leave us a voicemail. So do please leave us a voicemail with the reason you're calling and we'll get back to you ASAP. I know a lot of folks like to call and get a person right away. And we've had a lot of volunteers put in a lot of hours in that call center and we're trying to give them a break where we can. So do please leave us a voicemail. If you do give us a ring. Next up, besides our vaccine program, masking. I announced last week that the state had a program where we would be offering N95s as well as KN95s to the general public. And I mentioned last week that we would be announcing some more information a little bit later on in the week. We had a bunch of folks reach out to us, very anxious to get their hands on those masks. We were waiting on some more program guidance from the state. It's one of those situations where the governor makes a big announcement and then details start trickling in slowly but surely down to low-level folks like me. So now we have some of the details adequately lined up. We will start reaching out to folks today and we'll be starting some deliveries to a few select locations starting tomorrow. So if you reached out, you should be hearing from me shortly. Again, I apologize for the delay. We are waiting on some details on the who, what, and the how we could get masks to folks. But that's all starting to crystallize, so that program will be rolling out. And if you reached out to us already, we appreciate it. We'll be getting back to you, but we'll be making some announcements on that here over the next couple of days. Last but not least, on the non-COVID front, Saturday was an interesting time, I know for a lot of folks, myself included. With the volcanic eruption in Tonga created. And it was a unique situation that actually confounded a lot of the modelers at the National Tsunami Warning Center. Underwater volcano erupted, pushed some tsunami waves across the Pacific and impacted a number of countries and a number of territories. We were under a tsunami watch for a significant amount of, or tsunami advisory, excuse me, for a significant amount of time throughout Saturday. Ultimately ended up not causing a lot of major impacts here in the community, very fortunately. The advisory was very much a precautionary one for our area, although our friends on the west end, folks down in Oregon, the California coast did see some more significant impacts. We were under an advisory for about 1 to 2 foot waves here on the east end of the county. We really didn't see anything even that big. Thankfully, we saw no damages, but it was a good wake-up call for, we have a lot of other earthquakes and faults across the Pacific that could cause such a distant source event where the tsunami travels across the water and hits us a few hours later. Because it was just an advisory, the tsunami sirens, the AHABs, as we call them, down in the marina, out at Point Hudson, those weren't activated, and neither were the wireless emergency alerts. And those are the Amber Alert style that hit everyone's phone in range of the cell towers. We did send out a Nixle alert regarding the tsunami advisory. So if you haven't signed up for our Nixle text alert service, you can do that at our website, fcoeoc.org. Or you can text Jeffco DEM to 888-777 to get on that list. But with the advisory, mostly just stay off the beach. There'll be some additional smaller waves. In this case, we didn't even really see much of that. We saw some, quote, weird, stronger, unusual currents. But honestly, it didn't really affect a lot of folks' activities. I know a lot of folks were still going out on their boats. There was a poll in the PT Leader as to whether or not folks were concerned. 85% said no. I don't think this was a huge cause for concern, but it was a little bit of a wake-up call and a chance for some extra caution for us. In the advisory, just impacts the waterways. If it was a watch, that means damaging waves would have been possible. Finally, the highest level is a warning, and that's when evacuations would be underway and damaging waves are likely. So fortunately, we weren't in one of those situations, but I do encourage folks to go to our website, read up on potential tsunami impacts, make sure you sign up for NCSL, et cetera. But otherwise, thanks to all of our partners for helping get the word out, whether it was KPTZ, folks at the port, local first responders, et cetera. So a fun little wake-up call for us that I just wanted to make sure to touch on. So other than that, that's the end of my report, barring any questions.
Thank you, Willie. Greg or Kate, do you have any questions for Willie?
I do actually, one for maybe each, or maybe more of a comment, but Willie, it was surprising to see, and there was a fair amount of effort put into messaging things on Saturday so that asking folks to stay off of the beach, and sure enough, a lot of people flocked to the beach. So question kind of, you know, how do we get folks to actually pay attention when there's even if it's a small amount of risk, that it's serious, that they listen to that, in part because there are people who are trying to be responding to and preparing for risk, and they can, you know, just really be in the way of professionals who are trying to be helpful. So what's the lesson learned there?
Yeah, so, and this is an issue with every tsunami warning. Folks have a very morbid curiosity to go and see, you know, the wonders of nature and go and watch the tsunami. So it wasn't unique to this situation. This is a problem we've been dealing with for a long period of time. I am disappointed to say that a friend of ours texted my wife and decided to see my first tsunami, and it was a picture of him sitting on the beach. So little disappointing there. If there was a chance for additional impacts, again, we would get a little bit more forceful messaging out using the wireless emergency alerts, as well as the AHAB sirens. I'm hoping that escalation of notification would be a little bit more convincing for folks. We would also work to in the lead up to the arrival, patrol those areas a little bit more and actually use law enforcement, fire, others to make contact with those folks and actually shepherd them out of the dangerous areas. In this case, we did have a big thank you to our volunteer emergency communications group, VCOM, that the ham radio operators we use for communications when, you know, landline, cell phone, internet all go down. Some of those volunteers were out having an eye on the beach. They'd notice folks walking around and they'd go up and, you know, tell them about what was going on, and folks would brush it off. But in a more urgent situation, again, we'd use more forceful in-person messaging, and we'd use some of that additional emergency notification stuff we have at our disposal. So again, this has been a problem for a long time. I think we'll also be working with our neighborhood preparedness groups on some training and on some additional education and messaging on that front. But ongoing problem, I don't know what it is about folks, you know, when you see the car wreck on the side of the road, everyone slows down. In this case, you hear about a tsunami and you run to the beach. So another situation, we have to talk to our friends and family, do some more education, but also we had some more tools at our disposal we didn't use this time that we would use in a really dangerous situation.